You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Welcome to Open Society Foundations, and welcome to this book launch. My name is Allison Brown. I am the program officer for the Racial Justice Portfolio here at the Open Society Foundations. We're going to jump right in. I'm really, really excited about this. Just so you know, format, we're going to hear from our authors first. They're going to give a few minutes of remarks, and then we'll open it up to question and answer from you all. I'm so glad to see all of your faces here. We're really, really thrilled. As you all know, there has been tremendous momentum around school discipline and school discipline reform, really focusing on the disparities in school discipline that we see, especially racial disparities in school discipline and exclusion of children of color from the mainstream classroom. And that momentum has really generated movement from the federal government, from philanthropy, from a variety of different stakeholders, and is thanks in large part to the two people you see sitting in front of you. I will introduce Dan Lowson, and my colleague Lori Bazaller will introduce Marsha Weissman. And then we'll let them get into their remarks and then let you ask questions. So Dan is the author of Closing the School Discipline Gap, Equitable Remedies for Excessive Exclusion. Just a funny story about Dan. So I am in philanthropy now, but I'm a civil rights attorney by training. And one of my first classes in civil rights and education and the intersection between education and the law was taught by Dan Lowson when the Civil Rights Project was at Harvard Law School. So he is my professor and friend, and he and his data and research and activism have been incredibly important to the movement, to the moment that we see right now, to the advocates and others that utilize his data and his research to actually make a difference in classrooms for children of all kinds. And he is so important to this work, and I'm really excited for his work, for his new book, and excited that he's here with us today. And with that, I will turn over to Lori to introduce Marsha.
Thank you all for coming, and we really need to thank Allison for hosting this event, and also Eric, her colleague here, for making us all happy with food and drink and microphones and things, and Andrew back in the DC office who worked tirelessly to get this thing together. Also two people who aren't here, Kavitha Medirata and Tasha Tucker from Atlantic Philanthropies, who are also co-hosting and responsible for making things happen. So just introducing Marsha Weissman is a unique pleasure for me because I am, in addition to being at the Edward Hazen Foundation, a proud former board member of the Center for Community Alternatives, which she has been the executive director of for over 30 years now. You know, when people get up to introduce people, they often say they have worked tirelessly their entire careers, and you start to nod off, and it feels like a cliche, but I really couldn't think of any other way to start an introduction for Marsha, because she has, as I said, she's been leading this organization for over 30 years. She's also been an organizer and an advocate around criminal justice issues for, shall we say, a couple years before that. We won't put numbers on it. And the work that she does is particularly unique and that I find particularly compelling because it connects the actual experiences of doing the work and providing services and having interventions on the ground with people affected by incarceration and the public policy that drives those people to be imprisoned. And so, you know, they, at Center for Community Alternatives, they piloted some important programs that have now become, you know, quite a part of the way we think of criminal justice work, like alternatives to incarceration work. But they were one of the early organizations to get involved in doing that and saying people don't need to be imprisoned, we should be dealing with these things in communities. But then they also connect that up to policy work. So they also wrote one of the first reports, actually the first I know of, on the financial consequences of incarceration. And some of their new work is on the consequences of having college applications ask about involvement with the criminal justice system, which is basically the college version of ban your box, ban the box. So, you know, the other thing also to say about Marcia is that she's the classic lead from behind kind of personality. And having her on stage, she's a little uncomfortable with that, I know. But therefore, it's no surprise to me that her book, Prelude to Prison, is the voices of young people who are caught up in the school-to-prison pipeline. And that is a unique contribution. It affirms them as individuals with real experiences that are critically important. And it also, I think, brings something into our lives that we wouldn't have seen otherwise. So I'm very happy to be able to introduce her tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord.
So thank you for all coming here. It's really a great honor. I want to thank the Open Society Foundation for putting this event together. And Allison, it's a privilege to have been your professor and to just to, you've done amazing work in this area. And it's the kind of thing that just makes, you know, everyone just feel proud and excited when, you know, law school produces, well, you produced yourself, but when law school contributes to your development in that way, and it's just amazing. So I want to thank also Atlantic Philanthropies, and I should mention that, you know, I'm the editor of this book. This book is a real collaborative effort in the truest sense of the word. Tanya Koch and Kavita Mudrata were pivotal in not just bringing people together, but their voices, their input, their expertise informed the process from A to Z. And I know Kavita is not here, but Tanya is here, so I want to shout out to her. And Michelle is also was part of the collaborative, one of the collaborative members. And are there any others that I'm missing that are in the room today? But it was it's really important to note that this really epitomizes what can happen when people are working together. So I really feel fortunate to have worked with, for example, Russ Skiba, who was one of the leaders of the Disparities in Discipline Collaborative, in School Discipline Collaborative, and bringing everyone together. And it was influenced by another member, Pedro Noguera. Many of you may have know him, who was one of the ones who recommended that, you know, we receive some of the funding to put this book together. I also want to make sure, since this is being recorded, that you know, Cherie Hodson, who is a student getting her PhD at UCLA and was really responsible for shepherding through a lot of the nitty-gritty that went into the responses with the co-authors and just putting the whole book together, as well as a co-author of one of the chapters. I want to thank Tia Martinez and Shakti Belway and Joy E, the co-authors as well, and Alfredo Artiles and Elizabeth Kozlewski, who are the ones who approached me and said, we want to do a book on school discipline as well as some other projects that I hope to now be able to revisit. And they are listed as series editors. So it's really important to recognize their work, and they've produced several books that address inequity in education. So they're a powerful voice and, you know, harnessing Teachers College Press in a way to bring this kind of work into the field to influence policymakers as well as leaders and teachers in the classroom. The purpose of this particular book was always to bring the research findings to the policymakers. So we wanted to avoid being just an academic publication. And so a lot of the work that I did as editor was working with the authors to make sure that the way they constructed their research and the way they presented their findings would speak not just to an academic audience, but also to policymakers. And we know part of, especially on this topic, but in most topics when we're really up against structural racism and when we're really trying to change the whole framework of how we're looking at public education, when it comes to trying to get policymakers to change what they do, you have to not just present evidence of the problem, you also have to present them with some real practical solutions and evidence that these things work. So I've done work on the Hill. I've worked with advocates who are working to pass state legislation. And it was with that audience in mind that these chapters sort of came into being. And also, it's why some chapters, some excellent works, were not included in the book, because maybe they only spoke to teachers, or maybe they only spoke to what parents could do, or just described a problem but didn't really have a policy solution embedded. And so that's really what this book is all about. And hopefully, as you read it, you all find that there are pieces in it that you can use, so that in your own work as advocates or emerging students who are going into this field, that we're not just embellishing on what's on research, but we are informing the debate in Congress, in every state legislature, as well as with school boards and with principals and with teachers. So part of what we had to do is not just demonstrate that there is a problem, we had to do that and the urgency around it, but also demonstrate that there's something that could be done. And one of the key chapters, for example, on the front end of things, there are several. There's a chapter by Bob Balfance and his colleagues that one of the key things, and you probably heard, raise your hand if you've heard this in some form or another, that suspensions correlate with as much as a doubling of the dropout rate. Has anyone heard that? That's great, because that was a piece of information that came out of his research in Florida, and we presented this research before the book came out. We had a major conference, and then we presented it to members of Congress. So we're really trying to get this information circulating, and it's really encouraging that so many people have heard something along those lines, because that piece of evidence is rock solid. It's based on a longitudinal analysis of every ninth grader in the state of Florida, where they tracked them for 6 years. So it's really compelling evidence. And that, the fact that so many people in this room have heard about it is really important. Now, there are other chapters that have gotten less attention that we hope to elevate. For example, there's a chapter that shows that, again, a national longitudinal study that shows that before there are any signs of delinquency, students, elementary students and secondary students, before any signs of delinquency, they're being suspended out of school. In other words, the research in the chapter by Schallenberger suggests that kicking kids out of school is contributing to their delinquency, not just predicting it, but may be the thing that is making them delinquent. And you can understand the reasons why. When kids are kicked out, they're disengaged, they feel alienated, the trust breaks down, for all these reasons. Now, it's not a causal study, but it really helps drive that point home. And then there was another piece of research by Jeremy Finn and Tim Servos that looked at high security measures, including police. Now, a lot of people have heard about the fact that the Obama administration, in the wake of Sandy Hook, said we're going to give, I think it was $45-50 million for more cops in schools, and then also he said, or perhaps you can spend the money on counselors. But spending the money on more cops in schools makes no sense whatsoever. And one of the things that this paper shows, and that we've presented to Congress, is that it is counterproductive. It's not improving the sense of safety. It's decreasing graduation rates, and it's increasing kids who are suspended out of school. So when you add all these the high security measures, it's counterproductive. I don't think that one's gotten as much attention as it deserves. And we need more research like this. And that sort of brings to mind, we just released a report, so it's separate from the book, called Are We Closing the School Discipline Gap? And it has data from every district in the nation. And we rank ordered, we looked at elementary separate than secondary, and we rank ordered the suspension rates. We found that some of the highest districts, we looked at the 10 highest districts in the nation. Three of them are in Missouri, in St. Louis, in Normandy, Riverview Gardens. Michael Brown went to school in Normandy. And there, 50% of the students across the board were suspended out of school at least once in 2011-12. And there was an increase from 2009-10. Kids with disabilities in Normandy and Riverview Gardens and in St. Louis, 70-80% at the secondary level suspended out of school. This is just outrageous. And this really, I think, dovetails with the recent Department of Justice analysis, which where they were finding it's not just that there was this one incident that is extremely problematic on so many levels, but the whole way the city government was operating was not serving the community, but was trying to generate revenue for Ferguson. And it was just the antithesis of what good government is all about. And so connected to the legacy of Jim Crow and segregation that I believe that the kinds of data that we're seeing is really, it suggests that there are school districts that are operating like the city of Ferguson is operating, where there's no real interest in educating the kids. They're just there to work and do whatever they need to do to maybe raise test scores, but it's not about education. There's some really, and so one of the things that the report does that is really highlight the fact that there are just outrageous things going on in our public schools. It's not just about implicit bias, there's explicit bias. There's incredible effects from structural racism. And these are also supported throughout the book chapters as well. There are book chapters that zero in on the experiences, for example, of black girls. So Jamila Blake and her colleagues wrote a chapter that was really compelling, looked at the differences in the way black girls are treated compared to white girls, but also showing, and our recent reports show, that black girls are often the second highest group suspended. So usually, you know, there's that, oh, boys will be boys, and for bad reasons, people somehow accept the fact that boys tend to be suspended at twice the rate of girls. But black girls are being suspended at higher rates than any other males of any other racial group. And so there's something there that we, and so Jamila Blake's and her colleagues started to drill down, and that's presented in the book. It's the beginning of research that we really need to pursue more, in more detail. Our chapter on students with disabilities not only found huge racial disparities among kids with disabilities, but it also suggests that certain disability categories are much more likely to yield kids being suspended out of school. And guess what? The most frequent one is 33% of kids with emotional disturbance. 33%, one out of three, that's K through 12 nationally, suspended out of school. That suggests that there's something that we are suspending kids because of their disability that is blatantly against federal law and the Constitution. It's against the Equal Protection Clause. And this is going on in school after school after school. Instead of providing for the needs of kids with emotional disturbance, now guess what? It's also true that black students are much more likely than white students to be over-identified in that category. So there's a confluence, there are relationships here that this book just starts to dig into that we need to continue to not just research, but then bring that research to light of policymakers so that we can reject the status quo. And that's really, again, going back to, you know, this book is to serve the interests of convincing policymakers. It's not good enough to describe the problem. So one of the pivotal chapters is by Russ Skiba and his colleagues, where they show that what is the leading predictor of high suspension rates? It is the attitudes of the principal. So that's after controlling for race, after controlling for poverty. It is the attitudes of principals that are driving high suspension rates. And in addition, it's the attitudes of principals that drives up the racial disparities. So it's not just high suspensions, but the racial disparities that are predicted by the attitudes of principals. So the ones that have this sort of zero tolerance mentality, blame the kids, blame the parents, we've got to kick out the bad kids so the good kids can learn. They're not only suspending a lot more kids, they are much more likely to be running schools where black kids and Latino kids, other kids of color are suspended in disparate amounts. And that, to me, is also very powerful when you're talking to policymakers because it says schools can do things differently. So I worked really hard to with all the researchers to get them off the sort of dime of saying, well, you know, our findings are not conclusive, they're not generalizable to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Because researchers will always have a million caveats about why you can't, you know, draw too many conclusions or you shouldn't shape policy. And I say, no, no, no. There is no policy. There's no research behind zero tolerance. There's no research to suggest that suspending a lot of kids is good policy. But we're doing it. And we need to take what we have and say to policymakers, you know, we have strong evidence that this is counterproductive. It may not be a causal relationship, but we have enough for you to start rethinking your policies and practices. And the good news is that this is actually starting to happen. So the Council of State Governments in July just released their report, which brought researchers and advocates and principals and police chiefs and judges together, and everyone agreed that schools are suspending too many kids, that suspension, we have to get back to suspending kids as a measure of last resort, and that racial disparities are a problem. So the good news is that in the response to the book, as well as our latest research, the report findings that we just released, we're hearing a lot of superintendents say, yeah, we need to do things differently. So we are starting to turn the corner, but we're not there yet. Still, the fact remains that the federal government does not collect and report discipline data every year, and it's not disaggregated either. It's every other year. And this is a critically important piece of information. Community groups need this information. But it's all, you know, the data only goes so far. So in addition to data, we also need to have the support for what works. We have to use the data. We have to use the data to show what isn't working, but also to show the alternatives. And so that's where I think the most powerful chapters in this book are actually, there are a few of them. One is written by Talia Gonzalez, which is a six-year study of restorative practices in Denver. Now, for years, we've been hearing that restorative practices are a good idea, a lot of qualitative reports that this works for kids. But what this showed is in Denver, where they started with a pilot program and over the course of 6 years became a systemic approach to school discipline policy and trying to create a more healthy climate for kids in general, that during this period they reduced the racial gap. They didn't eliminate it. There's still a lot of work to be done in Denver. But the black suspension rate went from about 17% of all black students K through 12 to 10%. The white rate also went down, but not as much. So and Latinos also went down more than whites, but not as much. So they closed the racial gap. They didn't close it, they narrowed it. And they also dramatically reduced the use of out-of-school suspension. And during that six-year period, for every racial group, for every subject, at every grade level, Denver showed improvement on their test scores. And that's the kind of evidence that gets policymakers to wake up and say, yes, there is a more effective way. And our report, for example, shows that there are actually more low-suspending schools and districts than high suspending. So it's not the norm. Right around the corner, right within the same district, Los Angeles had the same number of what we call high suspending secondary schools, where over 25% of any racial group was suspended, and low suspending was where every group was below 10%. And there were more there were actually equal numbers of low and high suspending schools. That was in a study we did in 09-10. But it proved, and then we replicated that. In fact, we found nationally there are more, both elementary and secondary level, more low suspending schools than high suspending at either level. So there are, it's not just an academic study here or there. There's more to be found out about what's working. There are lots of schools and districts that are much more effective than places like you know, Normandy, Missouri, or St. Louis, Missouri. So in addition to that, we need the stories. And that's why, you know, the work that Marsha's doing and others are doing, putting that human face is really important. You won't convince policymakers with just data or academic studies alone. You need those stories. They use those when they talk about these issues, whether it's a state legislator, or a federal, you know, someone like Bobby Scott, they need those stories to really convince their colleagues and to make a change. But we need the data. And then the last, I'll end with this. So the researchers always, when as an editor, they're always trying to say, their conclusion is we need more research. We need to study the problem. And, in our book, we sort of shied away from that because this is for policymakers, and that's not going to really grab them. So we have a whole set of recommendations for policymakers, and we focus on that in the book. However, I want to leave all of you with this strong plea for more support for research, as well as for you know, the data and the support and legislation. We need to have the kind of research that is in this book. We need to replicate it. We need to do you know, find more districts where restorative practices. You know, at the state level, they're not going to listen to what happened in Denver if you're in Missouri or Mississippi or Alabama. We need to find success stories and promote that and put those side to side with some of these worst districts in the nation. And so I think I'll leave you with that, that the research is really critically important. And so thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy the book.
Hi, everyone. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks, Lori, for that really lovely introduction. And thank you. I'm the Hazen Foundation for organizing this. Thank Allison and OSF for supporting this, and of course Atlantic Philanthropies, and they're in some wonderful place doing some wonderful stuff. Before I get into sort of the thrust of my book, which I think is really good companion to what Dan's book is and what he spoke about, there are some folks in the room who came and to support me, and I want to thank you very much. I see two board members, Carol Eady and Sheila Rule. I don't think I'm missing anyone else. And CCA is an incredibly mission-driven organization, and we couldn't be that without the support of our board. I also see some colleagues in the room from what we call the ATI Reentry Coalition. And those are folks that I've worked with, who I work with for many years around reducing incarceration in New York State. And last but certainly not least, I really want to thank, I see colleagues from the Dignity in Schools campaign. And I have learned so much in the relatively short years, shorter than the ATI coalition, from the Dignity in Schools Coalition about the importance of putting directly impacted people, young people and their parents, in the forefront of the struggle to end both incarceration policies and school discipline policies. And it's really helped me do this book. Even though I've been, quote, a practitioner for many years and created this organization, the Center for Community Alternatives, that works to reduce incarceration, my heart has always been in research. And then there's a long, ridiculous story about me burning my first dissertation in 1975. You can talk to me over wine maybe about that. But I always wanted to finish. And so this is actually my dissertation after my kids grew up and my grandchildren aren't ready to go to college. So I have a moment before I, you know, have to look at them and support them. And it really is it helped me take a step back and think about the work that we do. And I say that collectively because I think a lot of us in the room are doing variations of this work. Actually, from a beginning from a theoretical perspective, but looking at how young people themselves could really live out and show us that theoretical perspective. And while it's probably way too wonky to share with policymakers, I think it's really important for folks who do the work occasionally to take a step back and think about what systems are we embroiled in that put us in this place. And for me, I look at the school-to-prison pipeline issue as intimately connected to mass criminalization in the United States, and mass criminalization to be fundamentally a social justice issue, a human rights issue, and a civil rights issue. And it's no accident, and by that I don't mean people sit in a room and conspire overtly, but it's no accident that schools have become the latest victim to be sucked into criminalization. And to some extent, it reflects some of the dilemmas that have always faced public schooling in the United States. And what really helped frame my understanding of what the children were telling me is something called social reproduction theory. And essentially, a lot of that focused at one point in time in the role of schools to socialize, if you will, children from the working class into stepping into their parents' shoes. So it was a mechanism to sustain current social structure, economic structure. But when you look at sort of post-industrial America, and yes, there you go, you can't use this with policymakers, that word wouldn't resonate. But really, when you look at post-industrial America, right, when jobs have disappeared, right, and you combine that with the relentless oppression of communities of color, it does help to explain the school-to-prison pipeline. And the transformation of poor urban schools, not into places that are preparing kids for industrial jobs, but rather preparing them to enter prison. And I think even if we never say these words to policymakers, those of us who are doing this work really have to know where it comes from in order to push back against what we're going to face, right, as we get some victories, right? But they're very fragile victories, and they're fragile victories because of the essential role that that race and class plays in the United States. And so I want to sort of walk folks through the voices of young people in how they experience the school-to-prison pipeline. And I'm going to do about four vignettes. They're pretty short. And I'm going to start with Jada, and all the names are pseudonyms. And Jada accompanied me and several other young people as part of the U.S. Human Rights Delegation in, I think, 2006, 2008, to testify in Geneva, Switzerland, on U.S. compliance with the Treaty to End Racism in All Forms. And this was her testimony to that committee. I would like to tell you what it is like to be sent to an alternative school. You always feel judged. Teachers don't give you the benefit of the doubt. Out of the 70 students who actually attended school every day, I remember only seeing one white boy. At my regular school, about 60% of the students are white. Mid-year, I was put into a program called 3-5, which means I went to school for 2 hours a day. I fell behind in my schoolwork and was only taught math once a week. The teacher was there every day and didn't really teach us. She only gave us dittos on worksheets. I'm in the 10th grade, but I have to take 9th grade classes. I felt like I was in jail when I was in the alternative school. Sometimes I had to be checked 3 times a day and checked before I went into certain classrooms. It's very uncomfortable being searched because I really don't like to be touched by other people, especially people I don't know very well. It's more uncomfortable for girls because sometimes they check you around your most private areas, and it's just uncomfortable. I feel like the alternative school system has set up kids like me to fail. You go back to school so far behind that you just want to drop out of school. I would like to end by saying that we need to look at why kids like me are suspended and, if at all, get rid of alternative schools. And that really captures all of the things that I heard from young people who I interviewed. The other interesting thing that belies the myth is how children understand their own behaviors. And contrary to what you often hear when you're trying to reform school policies, all the kids I interviewed took ownership of their own misbehavior. But much like the criminal justice system, they were desperate to have people understand the context of their behavior. And much like the criminal justice system, they thought they were overcharged. And they wanted desperately an adult to hear sort of what we who work in the criminal justice system understand as mitigation. And so here is what Roland told me about his bad decision, right? Well, it was all an incident on the bus where my little brother, well, he brought a knife to school, and him and another student got into a disagreement which turned into a physical fight. He, my little brother, pulled out the knife and he attempted to stab the other student. So I broke up the fight and tried to take the knife away from my little brother. And the knife was in my possession, which I guess they literally had no choice to send me to the alternative school because it was in my possession, right? So there's a young person who understands the school rules. He understood zero tolerance, but he didn't understand zero tolerance because nobody listened to him about how this came about, right? Here's the other thing that we often forget when we hear when we suspend kids out of school, what else they worry about that gets attached to their suspension. And so this is Janella, and she was really worried because she was getting suspended, or she was suspended, and she says, I'd be stressing a lot about that. I'm trying to do good, but like, I'm stressing. I worry about my family more than school, and it just takes me off track. And I worry about my mom because I want to make sure my mom is happy and my sister's happy because I know she's depressed. And I'm worried about getting suspended because I think that the white CPS, Child Protective Services, is going to get into our business and take me away. And I'm not trying to leave my mom for nobody. And that's also why she doesn't talk to people in school, some of whom might well be very supportive, but because her family experience and her life experience has been that when you go to an authoritative person, it doesn't wind up like you think, that something worse tends to happen. Here's an example of what one young woman experienced when she was stopped for her misbehavior, right? She had a pass. The officer didn't believe she had a pass. She was taken to the office. She asked to call her dad, right? And she was on the phone with her father, and then the principal, he's 6'2", now I'm reading, 200 pounds or something. He's a big dude, and he comes in, and he yells in the phone and tells my dad to get off the phone and stop calling, and then hangs up on my dad. Then they put me in handcuffs because I was throwing a fit because they hung up on my dad. They actually had the police officer come in and put me on the ground and handcuff me. But then after he had me in on the ground, the principal came in and sat on my back, and it made me cry even worse. And again, not all suspensions play out that way, but it surely wasn't the only story that I heard that played out that way. The other thing that prepares kids who are in the school-to-prison pipeline, who are going to these hearings, for becoming involved in the criminal justice system is the hearing process itself. And I'll tell you, this completely freaked me out because it was so much like the defendants we work with, that's so much like their stories. And so here is what a young girl named Tanza told me. The hearing was crazy. I was scared because I had never been to a hearing before. They closed the door and they got you speaking on this mic and they were talking like you were in jail or something. Because this lady, she got this big old thing. It's like a confession that you see on TV. They have a confession tape. They have one of them, and I was like, oh my God, right? Another story about the hearing, very quickly. It's just like court. You go in there, the hearing is just like court. Pretty much you go in there, they overrule you, and they just give you your time. And how does this impact kids? What do they take away from it? So they go into an alternative school, and this is how the alternative school was described by one young man. They're actually setting kids up to go to jail and stuff, because basically you have no rights, especially when you get to the alternative school, because they make you take off your shoes and everything when you come through the metal detector. They don't just tell you to go through the metal detector, they wind you down. You gotta take off your sneakers. Then if they think you got something, they make you take off your socks and all that other stuff. And that's just like going to jail. Once you're in there and there ain't no way out. The psychological toll is something that literally left me crying oftentimes after I finished the interviews with kids. And here's what Roland told me, and Roland is the young man who took the knife from his brother. My suspension hearing was horrible because of the things that they were saying. I thought in my mind that the things were saying, they were actually trying to make me look, you know, bad. I thought in my mind they were trying to make me look like a bad kid. They were actually trying to make me look like I was a nobody. And I was so mad at that, the hearing, because, you know, I thought they literally tried to make me look bad for real, and it was horrible. They were all talking about how I don't go to school, but I do. They were talking about how I don't go to class, but I am in class every day. I don't do my work, I do. They were just trying to make me look like I was altogether bad, that I was literally a nobody, and that hurted me. And the last section that I'm going to read from, you know, I did ask all the kids if they sort of knew what the term school to prison pipeline meant. And for all of us that are so embedded to that in that term, it didn't mean anything. You hadn't heard it, right? So then I asked them to try to sort of guess what it might mean. And there were lots of good guesses, but one definition or description by Raekwon was really blew me away. And for those of you who are familiar with the work of Bruce Western or Lockwell Quantz, I mean, he sounded like them to me, right? So this is what Raekwon said. Yeah, like school staff, they're looking forward to you going to jail or messing up your life and being nothing. It's just the fact it's like they don't want to teach us no more. It's like America itself. They just want to see people locked up just for the fact of it. People can't maintain themselves, so they put them in a cage because they just want to see us. Again, the whole thing about how they end up in jail or prison, when they come out, you might as well say they're still inside because half of them are now on probation or parole and they got somebody watching them. Or if they're not on probation, they can't do much. Like if you're not on probation, like if you're coming home from prison, you can't vote. Then as soon as you get out of jail or prison, you gotta have a job in a certain amount of time or they're taking you back or whatever. So once you come home, you really don't have too much rights. So you really may as well say you're still there, a slave. I do want to end with one optimistic statement, right? And we see that every day in the work that we do, right? And it is, I think, a companion piece to Dan's optimism about seeing some changes in sort of policy around those issues. But the changes in policies are not due really at the end of the day to like Dan's work, as fabulous it is, or our work. It's really due to the young people and the parents themselves that take up this issue. And I saw it firsthand in the group of kids that we got to take to the UN convening. And Jada, who opened the story, at the end of the trip, she looked at me, and there's a lot more I could say that she said during the trip. But she looked at me and said one thing that I think we have to hold dear to our hearts. And she said, we're all activists now, and that's how it's gonna change. These kids tell you that. Thank you.
So we'll take questions. now. Are there questions or comments?
Thank you very much. My name is Jesse, and I'm the executive director of Global Youth Connect. We run programs around the world, and we run a Human Rights in the USA program. I also have a connection to schools because my brother is a principal of both a founding principal of the James Baldwin School in New York, a small school, and has since moved to Vermont. My question is on his behalf, which is about any data related to small schools and whether it makes much effect to have a smaller school where the principal has, say, fewer students to take care of and to care about, if that's a factor in any of the research or anything that you've been studying. Thank you.
So we could look at that. It's sort of a double-edged sword because the smaller the school, then the less reliable the data are because we're looking at things like suspension rates. And if there are only, say, 10 black kids in the school, each one counts for 10%. So it becomes more volatile. That's something we could certainly look into that to see whether, after you control for that problem, whether small schools tend to suspend fewer kids or not. We do know that charter schools, which are varying in their size, tend to sort of parallel the suspension rates that we see in traditional public schools. So we have sort of the polar extremes. We have a lot of charter schools that are suspending kids right and left, but we also have charter schools that are suspending very few kids. Is there
anything on that one? I don't have data on small versus big schools. I can tell you in my book, in the chapter that quotes kids about what school what works for them. Two of one, they all told about being able to have a personal connection with an adult or several adults in a school. And one of the things that they liked about the alternative school, and the alternative, I should have explained this, is a school that kids get sent to if they've been suspended for a year, right? And to call it a school is really to take liberties with what we all think about as a school. But one thing they did like was small classes, mm-hmm. right? Now, the classes were small because kids didn't go, but on any given day, mm-hmm. right, the school actually was overcrowded in terms of all the kids that were pushed in as the year went on. But on any given day, the classes were small, and the kids really did like that.
I should add one thing, and I see someone else has another question, so I'll be brief. A common theme throughout the research on what does work, and I only talked about Denver, but common theme, including the chapter about Chicago, was when you schools that invested in teacher-student and teacher-parent engagement, those schools had higher achievement, had lower racial disparities, and tended, even when you were looking at in the Chicago chapter, for example, even schools serving kids from the highest crime neighborhoods, they had the best safety ratings and the lowest use of out-of-school suspensions. So these things go hand in hand. Now, if you had a small school but the teacher-student ratio is really large, you know, that may not, it might not translate. But the idea that in a smaller school, there will be more contact with parents and teachers and sort of more student engagement and better relationships and building that sort of warmer kind of climate. I think it's easier to do in a smaller school, but it's not necessarily a prerequisite. I think the key is that engagement between students and the teachers. That seemed to be a common theme. And there was another chapter by Ann Gregory where teachers were trained in improving student-teacher engagement, and they eliminated the racial disparities and dramatically reduced out-of-school suspensions.
I'm in education for 52 years. Why so long? Because I graduated from university, I have my PhD and advanced doctorate degree in correspondent course, so I'm working all the time. Most of my career was in postgraduate education. But in America, I know already what this means to teach kids. most profound experience and impression what I have from educational experience, it was a speech by principal of school in Afghanistan during ATIAS Foundation meeting. Girls walking 10 miles every single day to attend the school. They're sitting on the floor because Taliban would shoot, even they have guards, through the window. Girls not supposed to study. When she brought her girls to America, they overperform every Americans with whom they met. What motivates them to study like this? That's still open question for me. In country where I'm from, and what excuse to certain degree that I'm going to speak not very politically correct. After revolution, 80%, more than 80% were illiterate. In 10 years, country became most educated country in the world. It was very strict discipline. I remember myself as a kid. No excuses for any deviation. Now Russia has democracy. Nobody, God forbid, would touch a kid or punish. Parents would defend kids, not cooperate with teacher. And education in total catastrophe on all level. In America, most delicate question, but I did not originate this question. Chinese kid came with parents. They don't know English. They came from poverty, totalitarianism, and they overperform everybody. They're in best school. And racism, you know, white racist afraid of Asian because Asian would always overperform in science, in technology, in art. So I appreciate your work. You did a lot of job. But there are many really controversial questions. And practically, whenever I attend discussion about education in America, I never hear answer to this question. America spent on education almost half of money what whole world spent. This all complain about money. That's more than everybody else. And results? Thank you.
I'm not sure exactly what the question was.
I think it was a comment.
Yeah, so, but I would say that it's important to look at the research about what works and what works in the context of American education. And it's also important. It's important to look at what works in terms of the research on American schools and what doesn't work, and to stop what doesn't work, to do what does work. So it's very simple in that, you know, I really don't know about the sort of the international piece of this, but we know that kicking kids out right and left is not effective. That it leads to, it's also very expensive, so it leads to higher dropout rates. We tend, in America, I don't know about other countries, but I do know about other countries. In America, we incarcerate a higher percentage of our population than any other country. And part of the reason is that we're kicking kids out of school right and left for minor offenses when we don't need to. I was a teacher for 10 years, I can tell you from my personal experience. I was inexperienced. I was sending kids to the principal's office right and left. Fortunately, I had a good principal. She said, "Dan, you have a classroom management problem." And I said, "You're right. Can you help me?" And I got help. I got training. There was support. By my last year, I sent no student to the principal. In fact, we started a school without a principal. And we had very high achievement scores. So keeping kids in, if kids are out of school, they're not learning. And the data show that there are very, very effective ways to educate kids without kicking them out, without excluding them. And then there's a whole legacy of racism and Jim Crow in this country that don't exist in every other country. They have other legacies. But in America, we've had a longstanding policy of, especially for black students, of a caste system. You know, after slavery ended with Jim Crow, and also intentional and then informed less conscious forms of racism, and we're experiencing the legacy of that. So the denial of educational opportunity is obvious. the evidence supports it. And when you stop denying educational opportunity, students do take advantage. They are successful. And there's no question that the status quo is broken and counterproductive, and it hurts us all. So, I hope that it's an indirect response. Other?
Casey? Question.
Hi, my name is Casey. Thank you both. So I'm trying to formulate this as I ask. And so, Daniel, you mentioned earlier about engaging with policymakers. And I think the research that you and Russell Skiba and other researchers have done have been tremendously helpful in shifting policymakers around school discipline. I wonder if those conversations have begun to lead to policymakers acknowledging some of the intersection of their other policies that perpetuate the school-to-prison pipeline. And so, for instance, the over-reliance on testing and the kind of oppressive nature that that creates for both students and teachers in a school, the lack of regulation of public schools, and this kind of de-districting, I don't know what you would call it, of school districts, especially urban school districts, where students are now traveling outside of their communities, many, you know, far away to go to school. And I think of a story that happened in Detroit where a young woman, by all accounts, was an honor school student, and Detroit has a system where she was actually attending school in Dearborn, which was all the way across town, a suburb outside of Detroit, and her grandfather had given her a small pocket knife because the traveling was particularly dangerous for her, and the night at times she was out. They found a pocket knife at the school. She was expelled in her senior year for the year, and that, you know, there's really a convergence of policies that are kind of intersecting in our schools, and I wonder if policymakers have started to engage and acknowledge the other policies they're supporting, specifically our Department of Education, which has, I think, really supported the need to change school discipline policies, but then support other policies that are also kind of perpetuating and maintaining the kind of environment that leads to push out.
So before you answer, after Casey's question, I saw Don's hand. So I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So we'll take those 5 questions all at once. 6, 7. 7 questions all at once.
Okay. So the
Well, maybe we'll break them up. We'll do 3 and then 4.
And that last question had like 10 parts to it. So, but I'll try to answer at least some of them. One of the things I think it's important to note is that accountability system currently is focused on test scores. But it wasn't just because of No Child Left Behind. About half the states have high-stakes exit exams for earning a diploma in high school. And these do have, have been demonstrated to have a disparate impact on kids of color, partly because of the resource inequalities. Kids are being tested on curriculum that they haven't been taught. Poor and minority kids are much more likely to be taught by out-of-field, uncertified, inexperienced teachers. So there's a whole piece about resource inequality that is also clearly entangled in what we're seeing with regard to the high rates of suspension. And the latest thing that I think I'm most concerned about is evaluating teachers and teacher performance and whether teachers maintain their jobs on their before and after test scores of their students. So there are some incentives that are where I think even some well-meaning educators haven't thought about the unintended consequences, which is to push out the low achievers, especially where there's no other kind of accountability. So one of the main policy pieces that we're using the research to inform and push forward is to broaden accountability, not to do away with accountability, but to make accountability more holistic, to look at the school climate, to look at graduation rates of grade retention, other things that really matter in terms of life outcomes of students. And so I think it's important to have that sort of balance rather than just looking at, you know, reading scores in math and scores in math and reading. It's an interesting thing. I've worked on desegregation remedies in Hartford, Connecticut. The Civil Rights Project is one of the leaders in studying and analyzing the patterns. And we are actually in a period where schools are more segregated today than they were in the late 60s. So a lot of those programs, there isn't actually a great deal of cross-district integration, and I think we actually need more of that. There are concerns, of course, where maybe a mostly white district will, because of implicit and maybe explicit bias, will push those kids down. And we have seen examples even within magnet schools where kids are tracked, the black kids are tracked, even in a magnet school, to the low tracks. And so it's like you open the schoolhouse doors and it's a segregated school within that school. So those are concerns, but you can't address those concerns where you have racial isolation. And our data suggests that you have much higher suspension rates and also a propensity to hire these sort of really harsh disciplinarians only in these racially and socioeconomically isolated school districts. That's where we see the Joe Clarks of the world. You would not hire a person like that in a sort of a well-integrated suburb in Boston. Marcia, you want to?
The only thing I would add to that, again, is sort of the human face of what's high achieving and low achieving. An example, so the young people that we work with who are pushed out of school are presumed to really have no talent for much of anything. And there was a poetry contest a number of years back, and part of the work that we did with kids was offer them, poetry writing opportunities. And we entered their poems into this countywide contest, and our kids, they awarded 16 awards throughout the county, many school districts, many schools. Our kids won 4 of the awards. So a lot of what achievement is about how you teach kids, what you teach kids, what the curriculum is, how you engage them, and how you make them feel it means something to their lives.
Thank you both. I'm so anxious to read both books. First, Dan, I wanted to ask you, does your book address how sometimes children with depression or emotional disruptions are labeled as special ed, and does the book also address the stigmatization of kids in special ed? And Marcia, I wanted to ask you, is there any policy work underway, as far as you know, that addresses maybe returning some of the kids that are doing better in the alternative schools to return them back to their regular schools earlier than a year?
I see the next three questions. So that question and the next two in the order. Don was next. Let me get Don, and then you'll be number three. And then we'll start with you the next round, okay?
I wanted to first comment on the international question, but I will end in a question, I promise. Commentary. Most countries use the systems that they have available as forms of social control for the populations that they don't want. In this country, it happens to be LGBTQ kids, immigrant kids, kids that don't speak English, kids of color, go down the list, right? Think of Europe, Roma kids. They classify half of them as kids with disabilities, put them in shitty schools, and don't educate them. Okay, that's the trend around the world. It's different dynamics everywhere, but that's what happens. That's why we're in the fight against the government monopoly on state violence in different forms. Okay? That's what this is about. That's a part of the international trend. The question, Dan, to you, clearly, I'm drawn to the provocative, as are you. That's why we think alike. You made a comparison to Ferguson, and I thought that was really interesting. I wanted to ask you to tease that out. You talked about how schools are similar to the way that the city government in Ferguson operated. I don't know if you meant in the way that the government there has been characterized as operating as a business on the backs of low-income communities of color, and you made the comparison to high-stakes testing. I wanted to ask you to tease that out. That's my question.
Thank you. And then number three.
My name is Patrick Van Sleitman. I am the Director of Education at New York City Probation. And I want to thank you for the work that you're doing, because it helps me when I meet with DOE, right, which is always a major issue. Mm-hmm. We live in a city where there's supposedly lots of progressive, right? There's a progressive mayor, there's education folks. But when we remove our kids from one school to get them into a different school, which is hopefully a better school for them, dismissals, suspensions follow them. My question to you is, what would be a good way to engage DOE, to engage the principals? Because what I have found is that having a different teacher, someone who understands the kids in a different way, makes a significant difference in how they react to that kid. And I have noticed over the years that you meet with different principals, one can understand and willing to engage in restorative practices, and the other one would look at you as though you have six heads.
So I heard four questions. So to Dan about special education, Marcia about returning students to school, Dan about your Ferguson implications, and to the both of you about kind of engaging educators. And I'm going to ask that you keep your responses brief because I really want to give folks time to get their books signed, and we have to be out of this room by 8 o'clock. So,
so one of the things, we have a chapter in the book that I was one of the authors on that looked at these sort of overlapping concerns with over-identification of especially black and black males and suspension rates. And one of the curious things, if you just look at the data empirically, you definitely see a disproportion. So among kids with disabilities, they all tend to be suspended about twice the rate as their non-disabled peers. But black students with disabilities tend to be suspended about twice the rate of white students with disabilities. But then when you break it down by disability category, which we did in our study, we found that it was predicted, the schools that tended to identify more kids as emotionally disturbed also tended to suspend high rates of students. And interestingly, the schools that tended to have higher rates of kids identified as autism, and this held true for both these cases, held true for both black and white students, they tended to suspend lower numbers of kids. So there's more to unpack there than we were able to do with the limited data that we had available. But there is a suggestion that the category and the stigma, and as I pointed out earlier in my comments, you know, black kids are much more likely to be identified in the stigmatizing categories of emotionally having an emotional disturbance, being mentally retarded, or now it's called an intellectual disability, and also in the catch-all of specific learning disabilities. Excuse me?
I'm sorry, does that include ADHD?
No, it doesn't. So ADHD usually falls within this otherwise health-impaired category. But for the most stigmatizing category, that is also the one that you would expect, if you have emotional disturbance, that you would need a behavioral improvement plan, that you would need behavioral supports. And because the law says you can't suspend a student because of their disability, it's the most obvious that kids are being suspended because of their disability. They are being suspended because they have emotional disturbance. And that's blatantly unlawful whether they're white or black. But the disproportionality is that more blacks are identified as emotionally disturbed compared to whites. They're over-identified in that category. And the category where we tend not to suspend kids, the beautiful genius category of autism, and a lot of autistic kids have all kinds of behavioral issues, there's very low suspension rates for kids with autism. So they're getting, in some categories, they seem to be getting, and the ones that white kids are over-identified in, autism, they tend to get more supports, and it's a different approach to their addressing their misbehavior. So there's more to look at, and this is a topic that I've been actually analyzing. We have a whole book on racial inequity in special education. So it's not just the identification, and it's not just the discipline. There's also another concern with the placement in the school. So are you in the mainstream setting, part of the regular classroom, and only brought out for part of the day? Or are you mostly in a separate setting? And surprise, surprise, even within each category, black students are much more likely than white students to be removed from the mainstream. So there's a segregation effect within special education. There are policies that, we were able to help draft and get implemented into law, but they're not being enforced. I'll switch to, so I don't monopolize that.
So I'm just going to say a quick thing about... A quick thing about sort of the labeling. because it's really starting to disturb me. I think we have to be very cautious about what we're labeling, the over-labeling and the labeling of kids, and it's, you know, sort of the way that we're trying to make the justice system more attentive to needs, labeling kids as emotionally disturbed or with other mental health problems. A lot of the kids that we deal with, they're not emotionally disturbed. They've been victims of trauma, right? And if you read the book, there's examples in there of kids who act out, and when you talk to them, you know, when you spend time interviewing them and talking to them, somewhere in their story, they'll tell you, you know, about their brother being killed, or they'll show you the wound on their head or the wound in their shoulder. And we're pathologizing kids. And I'm not saying that there aren't real mental health needs among lots of folks, lots of kids, whatever, you know, racial characteristic, but that's sort of our new way of sort of not really grappling with the fact that we're criminalizing normative adolescent behavior for poor kids and kids of color. So I'll get off that. With respect to sort of Carol's question and your question about, you know, helping kids re-engage in school, one of the things we've seen, and we have done some actual quantitative look at this, that the resuspension rate for kids who've been suspended once is very high, right? It sort of cements the, you know, the label on their head, right? From a programmatic perspective, one of the things that we did, we had a DOE, a federal DOE grant in the early 2000s, and we evaluated it, that by when kids were returning from alternative school, and again, I talk about it in my book, it really looks a lot like re-entry, right, for those of us who work in the criminal justice system. All the reasons, all the barriers, right, all the things that you faced before you were put in prison are exacerbated after you've come back out, and that's the same thing for kids who are transitioning back into mainstream school, and they talk about it in eerily similar fashion. But one of the things that we've implemented as a programmatic response is something we call a transitional coach or a transitional advocate, and that's both to help kids reacclimate into school, but actually more to really try to get teachers and principals to give these kids a real second chance. I mean, maybe they shouldn't have been pushed out in the first place, but there we are, but not to immediately push them back out. Because I'll tell you something, and there's stuff in the book, that these kids come back and the adults in the school say, what are you doing back here? I don't want you back here. Oh, Mike Tyson, little Mike Tyson is back, right? So having an adult support that's there, particularly in the initial months of transition, really helps re-engage kids.
So Dan Ferguson, in 30 seconds or less.
Yeah, so far, that was a big question too. So there's a lot to unpack there. I think part of what we're seeing in places like Ferguson is that it's the antithesis of preparing folks for democracy. And that might be intentional, or it may be a reflection of structural racism where, you know, blacks were never supposed to be part of our democracy, you know, because after slavery there was a resistance with Jim Crow and so forth. And so the idea that the school districts and the school authorities are exercising control in a way that says, we want obedience. We're going to teach obedience. And anyone who can't follow and be obedient in this very concise way, you're out. You don't get education. We have really no interest in educating folks to be vibrant parts of our community. We just want you to obey the rules. And so I think when you're seeing 50% of black enrollment being suspended out of school, I think that is part of what is going on. And so that's also reflected in the way Ferguson is running their municipality, instead of serving a community, they're looking at the black members of that community as second class. It's sort of the plantation mentality that, you know, you serve our purposes or we don't. That's what it's all about. And so that's my 30-second response.
Marcia, do you want to talk about engaging educators? the question about engaging educators.
Yeah, I mean, some of it I took that question to be addressing the reentry issue. I know that from the work that we're doing in Syracuse, that's a really, from the work that we've been doing in Syracuse, and Dan did some great data analysis that, you know, sort of helped move the dialogue forward. But at the end of the day, it really is about confronting explicit and implicit racism, the staffing patterns in school, the culture that has been allowed to sort of fester that doesn't connect with kids. And so the engagement of educators is going to be a long, protracted struggle with, I think, lots of victims along the way. And that those of us who work in this issue, it cannot be enough to celebrate getting a good code, right? It really has to be figuring out ways of supporting the champions in each community, right? So it's very labor intensive, who are going to be brave and lead this change and support this change so that it happens. And engaging educators, you need to sort of elevate educators who get it. You know, and we just did that last week, thank you very much, with the superintendent in Syracuse is under incredible, horrific attack, right? Teachers Unite, that's a wonderful DSC member, does it with their colleagues. So we need to figure out how to do that. And again, parents and young people have to be front and center, because they're the ones who are going to say, look at me, I am a human being, I deserve to be educated, I want to be educated, and I want you to be my teacher.
So, and on the engagement piece, right?
Very
yeah, yeah. So I think we are experiencing a paradigm shift that's really important. So rather than, it's true, the status quo is true, that students sometimes go to these alternative settings or get a fresh start after they've been kicked out of school, and it might be better. They may not want to return to the original high school. They may find themselves in a situation where a new teacher, they're starting over, and they're getting the kind of support they need. But more often, the problem is that's just the exception, and the rule is that that's just a path, you know, the alternative placement, that's just another part of the path to prison. And what we have to have is a paradigm shift so that all teachers, all leaders are trained, beginning with higher ed, but also retraining of the teachers are there. And I have I was a teacher, my parents are educators. I believe that this really works, and that most people go into teaching or want to be school leaders want to do what works. And when you show them that it really does work, whether it's restorative practices or other kinds of interventions and teacher training, it's really very... It's positively reinforcing. So you feel better about yourself as a principal or as a teacher when you're not kicking kids out of school right and left, and the kids are successful, and the kid that you didn't expect to be able to succeed is actually, defying your expectations. And those examples are when you have some sort of commitment. And so I think we're seeing that kind of sea change. Principals confronted with their data said they're rejecting the status quo, even throughout Missouri, in response to a report. They issued a letter to all the superintendents saying you have to re-examine your practices and your policies around school discipline. So that wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. They would have said this is BS, we got to kick out the bad kids. Today, we're seeing principals like Sharon and many others start to embrace this, reject the status quo, figure out what works, and when they do that, it really is more effective. And so the answers are really there.
So unfortunately, and I know I see you, 1, 2, 3, I see you, I know, and I'm really sorry. But unfortunately, we have to wrap now. Marcia and Dan will be here. They can answer your questions directly, one-on-one. Please join me in thanking them both.